I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast that explores issues in agricultural and medicinal biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are answered using a science-based approach, with the goal of moving innovations to applications with communication. Now here's your special guest host.
Today's guest on the Talking Biotech Podcast is Dr. Doug Sammons from Monsanto. Welcome to the podcast, Doug.
Thank you.
So let's start with your background. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you went to school?
Well, I work at Monsanto now, but I'm a father of seven kids and seven grandkids. We live here in the central United States, just west of St. Louis. I went to school at Ohio State University and got a bachelor's degree in biochemistry and a PhD in chemistry studying enzyme mechanism chemistry. And then I did a postdoctoral research stint with the NIH-funded fellowship at the Penn State University and State College, before coming to Monsanto in 1984. So I've been here 33 years last Sunday.
Well, congratulations on that.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
So can you tell us maybe a little bit about what you do at Monsanto and maybe even how your role has evolved over the years?
Basically, what I do now is study glyphosate resistance primarily, and I do a little bit of RNAi work. When I came to Monsanto, I was in a herbicide design group discovery team and did that for about 4 or 5 years before I moved on to a natural product group that evolved into protein discovery for insecticidal proteins. So I learned some insect biochemistry. And then I moved back to herbicide physiology for 4 or 5 years. And then I studied seed physiology for a couple of years before going back to steward Roundup Ready crops around the year 2000 and did some work on the new generation cotton and canola and soy that we have today. And about since 2002 or so, I've been working on glyphosate-resistant weeds. Good evolution all around biochemistry.
Pesticide resistance has become a bit of a concern for farmers with weed management. So how do weeds and disease develop resistance, and what can a farmer do to help prevent that resistance from evolving? Could you define resistance for us as well and what that means?
Right. So we use the definition on the weedscience.org website. There, what we try to do is say the weeds that no longer are managed or controlled by the recommended dose are resistant. But in theory, when you're out there and you spray two times the herbicide because of overlap, it's really between the 1x dose and the 2x dose for weeds to be resistant, that survive, and set seed. So the key part there is they set seed and have progeny. And that would be a resistant weed. Now, some people say, well, you know, you need to take the next generation and make seed and demonstrate it again that it's heritable. But usually when you collect seed from the field, that's what they are. They're demonstrating heritable resistance.
So how do weeds and diseases develop a resistance?
Well, they develop by you know, a process similar to natural selection. I mean, if you put selection pressure on them by using a particular herbicide a lot in a system, then you will select for resistance. But in order for resistance to occur, you have to have survivors. And so for weeds, it's because, you know, we have this economic threshold for control. That is to say, it's easy to get 85% of the weeds dead or controlled, but it might cost too much to do the next 15%, so we'll let some survivors persist. And it's those survivors, I think, that are the nucleus for the resistance that we have today, because we don't really have a zero-tolerant policy, or didn't have for very many, many years. This is pretty difficult to do with other pesticides because fungi and insects are moving around a lot, so it's always been a problem for them. But for weeds in a stationary system, it's mostly because we allowed survivors, I think.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, so what would a farmer be able to do to prevent resistance from evolving then?
Well, these days, you know, a lot of people initially said, well, they need to rotate. The problem with that is, well, there's a couple things wrong with it. Rotation is a word that has a very positive connotation in agriculture. And mostly because of disease, I think, in crops where people planting the same crop over and over again accumulate disease that carries over from year to year. And so the idea of rotating crops was a good idea. And then the idea that the soil would be conditioned by different crops was also a good idea. But in weeds, rotating herbicides, as it were, doesn't really help you, because if the other herbicide doesn't work as well, then you let the selected population populate itself. And so when you come back to the other, you know, herbicide selection, you have more individuals to take care of. And so what people have found is that admixing multiple mode of actions does a better job of keeping the resistance under managed instead of blowing up. And so today our recommendations are generally to use a diversified system that takes advantage of multiple ways to control the weed. So some pre-herbicides, post-herbicides, in-mixtures, and then to think about the weed control system as an all-year process instead of just a seasonal process, because some of the weeds, for instance, in the Mid-South, the amaranth, Palmer amaranth, will come on near harvest and make enough seed to be a major problem next spring. And so it's not okay just to harvest and walk away. You have to worry about what goes on post-harvest and pre-planting. So sustainable management really then is all about making sure we take out more seed than we put back. And when we look at different species, we can see that some species, this would be very difficult when they have very high seed drop numbers like the amaranth do, hundreds of thousands of seeds, even in some cases per plant. And this makes it very difficult. So somebody like Stanley Culpepper at University of Georgia would say, you know, a dozen or so plants per acre is all you're allowed for sustainable culture in a cotton field. But for other plants that have many fewer seeds, morning glory or something like that, there might be a different tolerance level for sustainability. So we haven't adjusted our concept of weed management down to the species level yet. And I think that kind of creates a problem for us. And so there's some evolution going on right now in weed science and the way we think about that.
Do you think the development of resistance has driven that change in thinking?
Yes. I mean, the development of glyphosate-resistant Palmer in 2005 in the Mid-South and its spread has really found every weakness in our management system. And so, you know, some things we were doing we took for granted, and or maybe were a little sloppy. And this weed really just wrecked havoc where it was able to get a good footprint. And so that required farmers to be really good about managing it. And so I think it has driven a lot of concepts about how to do that in a sensible dollars and cents way, and that's practical.
So do you think you could very broadly explain the concept of RNAi and how it works?
Well, in plants, you know, it's in different organisms. Right? I think the process of RNAi is known in plants and in animals, for sure. I'm not so sure about yeast and fungi and some others. I think some people have made claims. But if we just think about plants and animals, and in this case, insects, there are different processes. So in plants, it can propagate, and in animals, it can't. So they're slightly different. They have different enzymes through the whole cycle. But the process is basically to shut down a gene. So a gene is being transcribed and then translated to make a protein product. And the general idea is that that protein is not made, is knocked down, less of it is made. And that creates a toxicity in its own right and or enables a pesticide to be more potent at the same dose. And so it's a regulation of gene expression in a couple different forms that it appears. It's thought to, in plants, I think it's thought, and maybe animals too, it's thought to have been evolved from a means to protect the cell against virus invasion and to block the expression of foreign genes. And it evolved into a system that the plant uses itself to regulate its development and morphological development, but also still uses to defend itself against virus.
How is this technology applied to pesticides? So what exactly is an RNAi pesticide?
Well, generally, these days, it's considered a double-stranded piece of RNA. For insects, they're usually a little bit longer, a couple hundred nucleotides long, double-stranded. And the insects take it up, and they are able to get it into a cell, and especially in beetles, for instance. It's easier to deliver RNA into an insect. And there, the RNA gets chopped up into lengths about 21 bases long, which then feed into the RNAi system. And the sequence, the antisense, so-called trigger strand, has to match the messenger RNA of the gene, target gene. And when that happens, then the target gene gets, target message gets cleaved and degraded. And that's there blocks the production of protein for that target. And so there's a lot of steps, and this is a sequence or molecules that are natural that normally appear in the cell. It's just the antisense is uncommon, and so the dose we deliver starts the process towards silencing.
So then how would this differ from a conventional pesticide in a very simple sense?
Right, so this is made of natural molecules that you have, so they're all completely natural. And you might then say it's organic, right? So it's sort of like a normal system. Conventional herbicides or pesticides are generally not natural products. They can mimic natural products, but they're usually man-made. And they may not have the specificity you would like, but a lot of them do. And so they're foreign to the target animal or plant, and so they're different, man-made. And so, but RNA isn't. It's common. It's what we have in us already.
Okay, so then what would some pros and cons of RNAi technology be?
RNA is fragile. It's a nucleic acid. It's pretty easily degraded in the environment, so it wouldn't last very long. And it's, of course, in the process of formulating it as a pesticide to use, it's very sensitive to heat. The double strand would come apart and then it becomes ultra sensitive to degradation. So it's a compound that we would consider fragile.
So it wouldn't work in all climates. It would like Lauren and I are up in Canada, so it might do better up here than it would for you down in Missouri or further south.
Well, I think on a standard summer day, we can formulate it and use it. I think you can't leave it on the tailgate of the truck.
Probably shouldn't leave a lot of things on the tailgate of your truck.
So, it's not going to be something that you can allow to get hot to the touch when you're using it. Not that we have to have refrigerators everywhere, but it's something that's going to be, once it heats up, it's going to be a problem.
So it wouldn't be stable year to year, would it? Like, if you bought this product 2 years later, would it still have the same efficacy?
If it was in the freezer, I think so. But this is when you talk about pros and cons, and this would be one of the cons, is that the large-scale manufacturing, production, storage, and handling is a kind of a new universe of understanding that they're building right now. So this is an area that people just haven't ventured into. And so there are a lot of small startup companies that are getting in this area, and I think they're making significant progress. So whatever we are at today is not where we're going to be in a year. But there's some major challenges here in learning how to make the RNA, how to stabilize it in a formulation so that it has a shelf life like a lot of conventional chemistries do. And that's going to be a challenge.
Other than agriculture, where else would RNA technology have applications in society? Like, would it have medical applications for human medicine or in livestock?
Well, I think that in medical applications, whether it's veterinarian or medical, I mean, there are a lot of people have tried to do this. I think the major pharmaceutical companies have spent literally billions of dollars because of the promise that it held. There are a couple of major difficulties. One is the delivery of the molecules in an animal system is very difficult. And I think that progress has been made, but some discoveries needed to be made. And I think a lot of the early effort was thwarted because people couldn't figure out how to really deliver an efficacious dose. And then, of course, once you've got it into the animal, into the bloodstream, you have to get it delivered to the target without getting it degraded. And so the pharmaceutical industry has resulted to a kind of a conventional drug discovery concept, and that is make the molecules non-natural so they're not easily degraded. And that's been very, very challenging and very expensive. So I wouldn't say they are defeated, but because there's such a huge promise for the ability to control some genes in medical diseases, but there is a lot of stuff to learn to make it so that it's routine. We're a long way from that, I think.
This might be outside of the scope of your knowledge about RNAi, but I wonder if for human medical applications, if they could make it work if they had some sort of coating that was harder to degrade. My cousin works with antibiotics and bacterial resistance stuff, and I know he's found that some bacteria have coatings that make them very hard to break down, but once you can get at what's inside very easily. So I wonder if that would work.
Well, sure, that's a sort of a standard approach for delivering pharmaceuticals, and there's a huge amount of their effort is built on just the delivery of the active molecule. And so there are lots of concepts, and there are RNAi working systems in medicine. There are some diseases for the eye and other typical specific disease systems that are approachable because of where they are and access for delivery of the RNA. So I don't mean to say that people haven't made good progress on some things, but as a general overall solving problems for every disease, it's got a long way to go.
So I think we'll take a short break right there. We're talking to Dr. Doug Sammons, and then when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about his views on working in food and agriculture. Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast.
Hi, everybody. This is Kevin Folta.
And this is Paul Vincelli.
And we're here talking about the next generation of potential opportunities with the Talking Biotech podcast.
And we have a very special invitation for you.
Okay, so here's the deal. What we're looking for is to expand the opportunities of using this vehicle to expose more people to the opportunities within science communication. How do you build your brand by potentially hosting a Talking Biotech episode?
Hosting a Talking Biotech episode accomplishes many things for me. One is I learn more about a topic that I'm interested in. And two is I develop some skills on science communication and do it in a way that's really quite friendly and interactive.
So how you do it is really simple. All you need to do is identify someone you would like to talk to, learn something about what they do, make the interview time to talk to them, and have the conversation. It's really simple. You do that, send us the audio files, and I'll take care of the rest.
And I'll offer myself to mentor somebody who wants to, stick their toe in the water and try it out.
Yeah. And in the days of standing up for science, there's no better way for you to stand up for the science you enjoy and that you would like to communicate to others than to share those important stories. And use this platform to talk about what you're interested in.
So think about it. It's a wonderful opportunity, and we're excited to extend it to you.
And now back to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast with Dr. Doug Sammons from Monsanto. Today we're talking about RNAi technology, its applications in agriculture, and Dr. Sammons' views on agriculture and the food system. So, part of my background is a grad student in weed science. I've had a few conversations with my advisor about RNAi technology, and just I've had a few questions. And from what I understand, you can use RNA technology to combat resistance. But what it does is the RNAi pesticide, it when you apply it, it will shut off the resistance gene in the plant. So then when you apply glyphosate, for example, after that, the glyphosate is then effective. So it's not actually the RNAi physically killing the plants, it would be the glyphosate after. It just brings the value back into our currently registered products.
Well, that's mostly right. I think the RNA serves to make the plant more sensitive. And so we've been able to augment several herbicides. So the RNA by itself doesn't prevent resistance, and it doesn't reverse the resistance for the survivors and the seeds. So it's not changing the genetics of the plant. But it does knock down the protein of interest and or related proteins that make the plant more sensitive, and thereby makes the herbicides more potent. And so we get better control. And in the case we're doing, we're using them simultaneously. So part of the difficulty is just the overall kinetics of each of the two processes. As the herbicide is working in its development of toxicity simultaneously while the RNA is shutting down the production of the protein, so that those two things are manifested together to give us the weed control we want.
So, Doug, you've been working at Monsanto for 33 years, and it's become a bit of a company that members of the public like to hate. So can you explain how the environment changed when members of the public started learning who you guys were and started hating you?
Yeah, that's been an interesting progression. Certainly when I started, Monsanto was a leader in the industry, mostly the fiber industry, and a lot of clothes, for instance, were wear dated. They had a guarantee that the fibers and the clothes that you bought were guaranteed. And if something wore out, then you could get it replaced. And so Monsanto was a very positive thing to the chemistry through better living sort of thinking in the 80s or before. And then as we got into biotechnology, I think a lot of people didn't know what to think. And there were some few people who were outspoken against it at first. And at that time, I think, I remember the advice was that if you argue with these people, then all you really do is raise it up and the attention level gets higher and higher. And so the best thing to do is just sort of be polite and it'll go away. Well, in fact, it didn't. And I think that was a big mistake for Monsanto, that intervening decade and a half or so that we let the misunderstanding of the science and the contributions and benefits be overshadowed by sort of the fake science and just illiterate science that was created. And so now, the effort is to be positively engaged and science education and calling out fake science where it is and not allowing people to just push an agenda that really is just all wrong and has consequences beyond their reach. The third world, you know, there's 100 million women in Africa whose lives would be completely different if they had herbicide-tolerant crops and insect-resistant crops so they could take care of their families and improve their everyday lives instead of spending all of their free time trying to make a food to put on the table for everyone. So I think that was a very interesting evolution, and it was, I think, it's unfortunate and sad.
If there was one thing that you wish the general public understood about food production and what you do for a living, what would that one thing be?
You know, I think I thought about this for a while and over the years, and, you know, what is it that I get a kick out of the idea that just this my little job and the little stuff that I do improves the world's food security. And I wish that the general populace understood or appreciated more how the science and technology that we use today keeps their food cheap and certain. You know, most of us, unless you're in the flood at Houston right now, aren't really worried about where your next meal comes from or what you're going to eat. It's just not something that we worry about. But there are a lot of people in the world that are worried. And it's in part because we haven't been able to let our technology impact them as well. And so I wish people appreciated the consequences of their decisions for their choices on the people who really rely on us to improve their lives.
I like that. I like that the small little things you do are making a small positive impact. I think I'm going to have to repeat that to myself when it's 35 degrees Celsius in the chicken barn and I'm sweating and have chicken poop in my hair. I think I'll find that a little more comforting.
Yeah, but I sometimes, you know, working in the greenhouse, and the old greenhouses had louvers. When the louvers would start to move, they screech and make awful sounds. And it always struck me that it just sounds a lot like a lot of people wishing they had something to eat.
Yeah. So if people wanted to find out more about you and your work, is there a place where they could look for you online?
Well, I do participate a little bit. I don't use Facebook, but I'm in ResearchGate, and I do have a Twitter account. So I think I'm at Wilted Weeds, and the views I express there are my own. And so you can reach me there. And I'm in LinkedIn. You can look me up in LinkedIn. And that's probably the best way. And so I think if they come through LinkedIn or Twitter, then it's something easier for me to work with.
That's good. Yeah, I was looking at your research. I was impressed by how much stuff you had published there. There was a lot up there. There's something like 70 articles there.
Well, and I'm not a prolific writer. I'm a prolific collaborator. And I've written a few papers, but I'm not, unfortunately, a good writer. And so I rely on a lot of my collaborators to do the writing. And so they are to be thanked for all of that productivity in part. But yeah, we've covered a number of different areas. And so it's been a good go.
So with that, I think we'll end the interview for today. Thank you again to Dr. Doug Sammons of the Monsanto Company for joining us to talk about RNAi technology.
Well, thanks very much, Sarah and Lauren. I appreciate you letting me talk to you guys.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.